The views expressed on this program are those of the individual participants and not necessarily those of WVUD or the University of Delaware. Welcome to WVUD's Campus Voices, weekly conversations with interesting members of the university community, visitors to campus, and others engaged in thought-provoking research and community service. Stay tuned for Campus Voices on WVUD.
Well, good morning, everybody, and welcome to Campus Voices. I'm Richard Gordon, and today, Vanessa Young and I have three cancer researchers with us. Terry Arnold is a founder of the IBC Network, and she's also a survivor of inflammatory breast cancer. You can tell that's what IBC stands for. And Dr. Angela Alexander is a UD alumnus of what, year 2004? Were you a double major?
I was a Dean Scholar in the College of Business and Economics.
And you went from the College of Business and Economics to cancer research.
I did, directly. Took the summer off and moved down to Texas.
Wow. And the third member of our panel is Sanjukta Brakataki, who's a PhD candidate in medical science here at the University of Delaware College of Health Sciences. And we're actually recording this interview the night before a really big event happens. What's that?
The defense. Dissertation defense.
Dissertation defense. That's right. That's happening tomorrow. So you're soon to be doctor.
Hopefully.
Yeah. Well, I think this is fantastic that there's this UD connection. But let's start with you, Terry, and let's talk a little bit about IBC, inflammatory breast cancer, and how you got started and interested in this.
Well, as many people do, they don't know what IBC is. They don't know what inflammatory breast cancer is. We think all breast cancer is the same, and it can be found with a detection with a mammogram, and you find a lump, things like that. But inflammatory is like a whole nother animal. It's skin changes or swelling or heat to one breast that you could easily mistake as an injury. And I got involved because I woke up one morning and one was different. It was hot and it was swollen. I thought I'd hurt myself. I went to the doctor and he said he thought I had an infection. But my breast kept getting increasingly worse. The skin got thicker. It changed. They kept thinking of different types of infections, different types of injury. But what we didn't know is I had stage 3 cancer already in my body. And it took 5 doctors and 4 months to finally get a proper diagnosis, start treatment. So my story is not that uncommon in the sense that many women don't know what they have and they have to fight for diagnosis. But as I went through treatment, women started finding me. I started hearing the woes of doctors with lack of research, people like these women with me on the panel today who wanted to study it. And then I got involved in research funding.
Now, what are some other symptoms that women can look for?
They're very vague in general, and they all kind of look like an injury. You can have a swelling in the breast. It's very sudden. Or a rash that looks like maybe either a bug bit you or a rash, or you can have deep itching or a shooting pain, things that could be easily dismissed. And one thing that makes it difficult is there's about 8 symptoms. They're kind of vague. And you can have one or all, but any time something happens to just one breast that you don't have a reasonable explanation for warrants a visit to the doctor.
What is it usually misdiagnosed as? Because I heard you say that it's not very often it's diagnosed properly.
Well, because of it looks like an injury, a lot of times doctors, it makes sense. They go, oh, you have mastitis, like maybe you're a nursing mom and you've got a clogged duct that's backed up, you know, and that can make you have a misdiagnosis. Just to FYI, if you have mastitis, you're going to have a body temperature. But the breasts will be hot, but you don't have a body temperature. Sometimes I think it could be an infection, it could be a reaction to birth control, it could be a menopausal change or things like that. And there's a real simple test you can do to know for sure.
Sanjukta, how'd you get interested in doing research in this area?
So first I started with nanomedicine lab, and I was working on formulation of nanoparticles to target inflammatory breast cancer cells. But very soon I realized that I'm not very interested for the biomaterial or biochemical part of the research, since I had 4 years of experience working in Johns Hopkins in the genomics lab. And I have a master's in biomedical science, so I was more inclined in doing my research in biomedical or biology of disease, to understand the biology of disease. So I went to Dr. Vengolan because I knew that IBC is not a very common disease and not many research has been done in IBC. So I went there and he gave me several options, and one of them was IBC skin metastasis, which was a very important but understudied area of breast cancer research. So that's how I ended up working on skin met.
That's one of the symptoms that Terry described, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, the fact that,
yes,
that how it spreads to the skin and now it looks all red and swollen and hot to the touch.
Right. Exactly. That's the one.
You described yourself as a preclinical researcher and Angela as a clinical researcher. What's the difference?
So in my current position, I work with patients. I'm in charge of several clinical trials, including enrollment, monitoring, collecting data on side effects, and working with the physicians to manage these side effects, and then collecting the data for publications and reporting to the drug companies what's happening with their studies. So my work goes beyond what's done in a preclinical lab where you work on cells or mice that are injected with tumors to actually see whether our hypotheses are correct in patients, because humans are much more complicated than mice.
So Sanjukta, what you and your lab have been doing, you're working on at the cell level and the small unit level, and once you progress far enough, then it goes on to a clinical coordinator.
Correct. So there are different phases of translational research. So mine is right now is T3, which is in the controlled environment, but we have collected enough data to go to the next step, which is to go with the in vivo study in animals and then to go to the clinic.
Angela, what got you into research and kind of drew you to it?
So I actually have a pretty interesting background. I was, like we said in the introduction, I was in the College of Business. And my freshman year, I took a class here, Viruses, Genes, and Cancer, which was an introductory course by Dr. Noble Harvey. And I got interested in cancer as a problem then. The following semester, I was a TA. And then I started applying to summer programs to get some research experience. Since I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do, but I thought cancer is such a fascinating problem, but I also wanted to help people. And so research married my scientific background as well as the person side of what I wanted to focus my career on.
And now that you coordinate clinical trials, there's some of your business acumen coming in.
Absolutely.
What exactly is UD doing about the research right now?
How about I jump in on that a little bit? Okay. Dr. Kenneth Van Godin is quite a shining star here at UD. He's actually a board member of an international consortium. And he and I met at a meeting a few years ago. And he had then later brought something to me and said, you know, there's no way I'm going to get this funded. This is a really small project as far as they view as impact-wise. But it's a huge project when it comes to whether or not someone lives or dies from this. And then he brought me Rhea and said, would you talk with her? And, of course, you can't say no to Rhea because she's amazing. And I call her Rhea, but that's not the name that most of us know her by, but that's her friend name. But anyway, I'd like to have her talk about that because she has a very compelling story why she picked this project and what kept her going.
Sanjukta? Yes. Thank you, Terry. That is true. I met Terry in one of the IBC conference at Harvard in Boston. And then I knew that when I went to Dr. Van Golen, there was no funding. He said, this project is, you are interested, I understand, but I don't have the funding to go ahead with the project. But he said, I have $7,000funded by IBC Network Foundation. So you can start your initial preliminary data collection with that and let's see where you end up going. So I said, that's fine. So I started my research and I collected those data and then I got my abstract got accepted for the Harvard poster presentation. So I presented my data there and that's where I met Terry and I got an opportunity to talk to her and then I mentioned her what we found so far and to go ahead with the research. We need more funding. And then she was so generous and so nice that she directly asked me, like, okay, Ria, tell me how much money you want. And then I was like shocked for the first time. And I was looking at Dr. Vingolin, and then he was like, no, don't look at me. You tell me how much money you need to finish your research. And then I came up with like for a few seconds, I stopped. And then I was trying to see what kind of experiments would be needed to complete my specific aims. And then I ended up telling Terry that, can we get $50,000 that will help us to do all my research? Because one of the major expense of my research was the RNA sequencing, and nobody has done RNA sequencing on inflammatory breast cancer cells so far. So it was a very impacting data. It was supposed to be very impacting data, but somebody has to do it. So but Terry was like on spot. She said, okay, I will fund you for the research. And that's when everything happened.
Why exactly has there been not much of RNA testing? Is it just funding, things like
that? Funding is one issue, but the major issue for IBC research is that lack of samples. So it's very hard to get samples, and it is still understudied area of research. So since there is very less funding, the researchers doesn't want to spend their time and money on a area which is very understudied and not focused by NIH or somebody else.
I have a comment to that, and it's a kind of a catch-22. I always say there's a hole in our bucket. Inflammatory is a rare form of disease, and unfortunately, the death rate is quite high. So often, by the time there is an opportunity to collect a sample, the patient's already had some treatment or been through something, and so is kind of compromised. So we have to find a way to catch them earlier, to get the samples, to get that tracked. Then we can go forward and then make an attractive appeal. And does that help?
Yeah, exactly. That is exactly the right answer, I would say. It's very hard to get IBC patient samples. It was said to be rare, but not anymore. But the thing is, like as Terry have described, that it is when a person is diagnosed with IBC, they have already reached stage 3 or 4, and it's almost late. And then most of the cases, they are at the end of their life. So it's hard to collect samples for them.
A question occurs to me as you're talking about that. It's hard to get the samples because it's not diagnosed till it's late. Sounds like a question for you, Angela, you clinical trial coordinator. What does that present any special problems once?
It does. So because the standard of care for inflammatory breast cancer begins with chemotherapy, generally upfront treatment, we only have core biopsies, which is a very small amount of tissue. Inflammatory breast cancer's presentation is more diffuse than the traditional cancer. And so when we put a needle into a woman's breast, we may only get 5 to 10% of that sample to be actual tumor cells. And that's a major challenge as well.
Is this like skin cancer in any way? I mean, the way it spreads around, or is it totally different? Angela?
The cells it comes from are usually cells that line the ducts in the breast. So they have breast markers. Or they could be lobular, which are also breast cells.
So it is a totally different kind of thing, even though it may look in some ways like some skin
cancer. It may look like a skin cancer, yeah, because early in the biology, it spreads through the lymphatics in the breast. And part of the definition is tumor cells within the dermis, which is the second layer of the skin.
Because I'm such a geek, Sanjukta, who Terry was calling Rhea earlier.
Yes.
I'm just fascinated by this idea. What is it that you're looking for when you go off and do RNA sequencing? And if you're looking at the genetic materials, what are you looking for?
That's a very good question, Richard. So mainly my focus was to see the difference between the gene expression, the differential expression between two conditions, which was my research focus, because I found that from the literature that TGF-beta, one of the molecules, which is known to be transforming growth factor beta, is in gets activated in the patient, IBC patient, which undergoes radiation. And in general, Stephen Wendler in 2013 have shown that there is very low expression of TGF-beta in the circulation and as well as the tumor of IBC patient. So my interest is to look at the difference between the IBC cells non-stimulated and IBC cells stimulated with TGF-beta. So mainly I was focusing on looking at the differential expression of genes between those two conditions and to that was, I did that because my main focus was to see if we can look for some therapeutic treatment looking at the gene expression, then we can focus on certain genes which might lead to some future therapeutic treatment for the disease.
That TGBF that you were saying?
TGF-beta, sorry.
TGF-beta, that's a form of radiation? That's you're talking about the radiation?
No, that's a molecule. That's a protein okay. in your body. It is present in your body, but for that, basically for the IBC patient, that the TGF-beta level is very low expressed. Okay. Saying.
So they've got a low level of that TGF-beta
right.
protein.
But when they undergo radiation, the TGF-beta enhances the expression. Enhances and that results in the higher invasion of the cells and that results in the aggressiveness and metastasis of the disease.
Just want to remind everybody that we're talking with three cancer researchers today, Terry Arnold from the IBC Network and Sanjukta Barkataki, also known as Rhea, a graduate student in medical science here at the University of Delaware, and Angela Alexander from the MD Anderson Cancer Clinic in Texas, but we've got her here because she's a UD alum. Vanessa, what would you like to ask them?
Do people with a certain genetic background have a tendency to get it more than others?
Well, I will address that. So we know that when we look for known breast cancer predisposition genes such as BRCA1 and BRCA2, the incidence is pretty similar in IBC and non-IBC. So the majority of IBC is not driven by these high penetrance genes, and probably IBC risk is multifactorial, some genetic, some environmental, behavior, pregnancy, no pregnancy, perhaps dietary factors, where you live. And so the disease is much more complicated than just you inherit this gene and you're definitely going to have this disease.
And I guess the receptor types have something to do with it as well.
Well, so breast cancer has multiple molecular subtypes is what Sanjukta was getting at there. And we know that in non-IBC, about 70% are ER positive. However, in
ER positive?
So ER is estrogen receptor,
okay.
and
Thank
that
you.
Means that the cancer is driven by estrogen, which binds to estrogen receptor. And this subtype generally has a better prognosis in non-inflammatory breast cancer. But we find in IBC, only about 50% are ER positive. And we see a much larger proportion that express HER2, which is another receptor that drives cell growth. And so we see about 40% of IBC has HER2. And being HER2 positive gives you access to drugs that target the HER2 pathways, such as Herceptin, Pertuzumab, and Kadcyla. We also see slightly more triple negative, and triple negative means that the tumor does not have ER, PR, or HER2. And patients who have triple negative, such as Terry, only have chemotherapy as their treatment option for systemic therapy.
Terry, one of the things I think is so scary about chemotherapy is it's basically poisoning the patient and trying to poison the patient such that the cancer dies before the patient does.
I understand. And I know I had friends tell me that maybe you could do something less aggressive. And I had to explain to them I had a very aggressive form of cancer, and I had to be equally aggressive back. And I know for myself, I wondered, would I throw up or, you know, would it be all those things you see in the movies? But honestly, I never threw up once. I gained a lot of weight because all the steroids. I got green and bloated and didn't look my best, but they did a lot to help the side effects. And I know sometimes women want to go alternative, and I'm all fine with complementary therapies, but chemotherapy is inflammatory is a very aggressive form of cancer. And without that treatment, I've seen women die in 3 months. So you got to really get your stuff together. But this is why I say hope always. I was diagnosed 10 years ago, triple negative IBC, and I am well. Everything worked.
Again, triple negative means?
The tumor does not have ER, PR, or HER2. So Terry did not have to take therapies against ER or HER2.
Part of that, though, means they don't know what really drives it, so I have less options. Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit scary, but when it works, it works.
Now, Sanjukta, because you're so focused on preclinical work, I think, did I understand right that what you're really looking at is how do the different treatments change the cells? Is that what you're really interested in?
Correct. And my main focus is the influence of radiation on the skin metastasis of inflammatory breast cancer cells. So my hypothesis is therapeutic radiation enhances stromal TGF-beta, which results in increase in the invasion of IBC cells' cutaneous metastasis. So basically, I was looking at if radiation results in higher invasion of the cells and if the invasion is due to the TGF-beta molecule.
When you say invasion of the cell, you don't mean the cancer cells invading the patient. You mean the therapy invading and damaging the cancer cells?
No. So I'm not working on the treatment part. I'm looking at what is driving these cancer cells to be more aggressive. Uh-huh. Is it radiation? And if it's radiation, what can we do to reduce the effect? Because radiation is very important for the IBC patient to take during the treatment, since they have it is such an aggressive disease. So there is a standard trimodal treatment, which is the chemotherapy, bilateral mastectomy, and then radiation, high doses of radiation. So radiation is not an option to opt out for the treatment, but what can we do to reduce the effect of skin metastasis for these patients so that their life is less, the quality of life becomes better.
I'd like to say why the radiation is so important, because I could see how someone in the audience might say, well, then let's just do the radiation if she's saying it might cause the skin damage to be worse. But here's the deal. IBC is webby and diffuse like cotton candy. You often hear when someone gets surgery, they get clean margins. Clean margins are hard to get when it's kind of scattered here and there. It's like when you break a glass, you sweep glass up for a week. Well, it's scattered throughout this area. So when you have radiation, it's a large field, about the size of a sheet of paper. And so they really need that to get that little sliver that's here, there, and yon that could actually come back and grow.
So basically what's happening is that the people are used to hearing about, if you will, standard breast cancer being a lump that you can mm-hmm. go get. Mm-hmm. But because IBC just sort of spreads over the skin and it could, you could have a red spot there, you could not. It might be there, right? Angela's nodding.
That's correct.
That's all you're going to give me is that's correct? As hard as you were nodding?
She was getting excited there, wasn't she?
So IBC does tend to spread through the lymphatics, and it spreads early to lymph nodes. And that's why surgery, bilateral or unilateral mastectomy, always includes removal of lymph nodes as well.
But it presents on the skin.
It presents on the skin.
So someone might not know they have it until it's too late.
A mammogram doesn't typically pick it up because they're set to look for a certain thing. And ultrasounds often miss it. So a woman can have clean scans and then something be happening and there's not a warning bell. It's more like it's like a pregnancy test. Either you are or you aren't. It's not like a smoke alarm that something's coming. That's what we want women to know. We don't want women to be afraid, but we want them to know if something's different with one breast, don't knock your common sense aside. You know, get to where you get a reasonable answer and then you can be satisfied because that knowledge might save your life.
Why exactly do mammograms not pick it up?
It's webby and diffuse like cotton candy, and it's meant to look for a lump. Angela, do you want to say a little bit more about that?
There's also a challenge in young women who have more dense breasts that tend to be more white on a mammogram, and so that can hide underlying lumps that may be actually there.
And when I said earlier there's a simple test, an MRI will not miss it. So if push comes to shove and you have to go through a mammogram, an ultrasound, a biopsy that may or may not miss it because of the webbiness, an MRI will not miss it.
But often because MRIs cost about 3 times as much as a mammogram, healthcare providers often require you to have a mammogram before they will let you have an MRI.
Terry, you were signaling you had something to add?
No, I was just saying that was a good explanation. I was excited.
Okay. Sanjukta, let's talk a little bit about the graduate student experience here at the University of Delaware. When did you come here from Hopkins?
2013 September. Not 2013, sorry. 2014 September, I started my graduate research here.
So you're going to get your PhD in under 4 years?
Hopefully, yeah, fingers crossed.
I bow to you.
And she has a little beautiful baby. This is a busy woman.
That's great. What have you found has been most challenging and what's been most wonderful about being a grad student here at UD?
The most challenging for me was balancing between my family life, dealing with when I started, my daughter was only 1 year old, so it was hard balancing my family life with the busy life of a graduate student. So that was challenging. But here at UD, I found like everybody supports each other very much. And then the research, if you are doing a really good research, you are being supported by the graduate office. So I received my doctoral scholarship award, as well as the professional development award and summer scholarship award, as well as I was working as a TA. So all my research, everything was covered. And then my department was very motivating and always supporting. Dr. Mary Martin, she was always there. And then, so that's a very good positive side that if you are doing good research and you are fascinated for science, UD is a very good place to start your career.
I just still think it's very interesting that Dr. Van Golen and Terry Arnold managed to get you funding for some of the things you were going to do. Of course, my experience was totally different. I was a humanities graduate student. They wouldn't give us any money. But that's fantastic that you got that level of funding for this.
Yes, I was very lucky. Like Terry is an angel, God sent angel for me. So.
Well, I have to say one thing about Dr. Van Golen too. When he first brought this to me, we had already allotted our funding for the year. We don't have a long funding season. We flip the money quickly as we can, and then we go raise it and we flip it again. And I said, tell you what, this means so much to me. If you will work with me, I will work with you. And can I make this in 4 payments? And he said, yes. And so his willingness to work with me made it possible for me not to turn her request down. So I'm really grateful for that.
Yes, and I want to add up that Dr. Van Golen is, like, I cannot expect a better supervisor than Dr. Van Golen, because he was very supportive and he was always positive. Although he didn't have the money, he was like, no, but this is a area which is understudied and not many research has been done, so we should do something to make an impact on the therapeutic or the treatment of this disease, so that the patient, the IBC patient suffering from cutaneous metastasis, they have a good quality, relatively good quality of life.
Thank you so much for coming into Campus Voices. Terry Arnold from the IBC Network, Sanjukta Bakataki, soon to be a doctor in medical sciences from here at the University of Delaware, and Dr. Angela Alexander, a UD alumna. Now working at the MD Cancer Institute in Texas.
Thank you for coming here, and we're glad to have you at 91.3 WBUD.
Thanks for having us. We enjoyed it.
Thanks for listening to Campus Voices. The views expressed on this program are those of the individual participants and do not necessarily reflect the official views of WBUD or the University of Delaware. For more information about Campus Voices and to find archived episodes, visit our website, www.udel.edu/campusvoices. We invite you to tune in every Thursday morning at 8:30 for Campus Voices on 91.3 FM, WVUD, and WVUD HD1, newark or online at wvud.org.